A campaign promised to cut crime and gang violence by 25% this hour. Ken Jefferson discusses his campaign for Jacksonville Sheriff. That's just ahead. And good Tuesday morning live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect, always live on the radio, and now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, don't miss it as we welcome JSO Sheriff candidate Ken Jefferson to Studio 5. He's ready to take your calls. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, exciting news as our own First Coast Connect Book Club partners with the Jacksonville Public Library. We'll tell you all about it. Plus, the exciting sounds of UNF's Great American Jazz Series, all of that ahead. But this morning, he holds a double-digit lead in the race for Jacksonville Sheriff. Retired Officer Ken Jefferson will face Mike Williams in the May runoff to replace outgoing JSO Sheriff John Rutherford. Jefferson has strong name recognition around town from his time as a spokesman for the JSO and also his work as a TV crime analyst with our own news partner WJXT-TV. He's promised to cut crime and gang violence by 25% in his first year in office. Ken Jefferson joins us now with more about his campaign and takes your calls. Ken, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. And get on the line now. You're already ringing up with your calls for Sheriff candidate Ken Jefferson. The number to join the show, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. You can email and tweet the show. We also welcome your Facebook comments. Lots of you already chiming in on Facebook. So, Ken, as I mentioned, you're a well-known face and name around town. Strong name recognition going into this runoff against Mike Williams. He'll join the show tomorrow. You hold a double-digit lead with a campaign promise to cut crime and gang violence by 25%. How will you do that?
Well, thank you for the question, and thank you for having me on the show today. When you look at the face of crime here in Jacksonville, the primary concern from all of our citizens is violent crime or crime in and of itself. And we have a problem here in Jacksonville with violent crime. Every day we look at the news, we're seeing where someone has been shot or someone shot and killed or someone stabbed in a nightclub or all these various incidents of violence that's going on. And then we don't really talk a whole lot about the crimes against persons such as sexual assaults and things like that that's going on. So all that's going on in the midst of the murders and shootings that we have here. What we did was, Melissa, we came up with a comprehensive, exhaustive plan after researching the crime in Jacksonville for the last couple of years. And we targeted the three main things that we felt was the driving force behind the violent crime, such as drug activity, gang activity, which produces overall violent crime. The statistics show that as far as the murders are concerned, 75% of the murders, based on the last study, were gang-related. And we have to admit that we have a gang issue here in Jacksonville. We can't hide behind the fact that gangs in Jacksonville doesn't meet the definition of gangs in L.A. and Chicago and all these other places. We have a gang issue here in Jacksonville. We have to address it. And as your sheriff, I intend to establish a proactive street crimes unit that's going to address the crime wherever it is. We'll depend on commanding officers to use their authority and the resources that I will provide for them as the sheriff to combat all of the violent crime that's going on. We'll depend on a software program called CompStat that will drive us to where the crime is. And when that starts to happen, the crime and the criminals have a propensity to move. And wherever they move within our city, that's where our street crimes unit are going to move until we drive it out. We're going to disrupt and dismantle all the crime that's going on here in Jacksonville.
We'll go to your calls for Ken Jefferson in a moment at 549-2937. Violent crime rates have gone up over the last year and a half. There was a rally this week after a man was shot in a struggle with a police officer Sunday at Jacksonville's Cleveland Arms Apartments. This is a huge campaign issue, both in the race for sheriff and in the race for mayor.
Sure.
Are you in favor, as Republican candidate Lenny Curry has pledged to do, to bring back more funding for the old Jacksonville Journey anti-crime initiatives?
Sure. And the Journey proved to be successful when it was funded because we had the resources, we had the manpower, we had everything that we needed to combat crime. And if he's pledging to do that, then that's a good thing. Whoever is elected mayor, if I'm fortunate to be elected as the sheriff, I look forward to working with them and furthering the journey's plight to help stop violent crime, because the statistics don't lie. When we were funded by the Jacksonville Journey, when the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office was funded by the Jacksonville Journey and all of the resources were properly deployed and we had the manpower out there doing the job, crime actually went down.
549-2937 to connect with Sheriff candidate Ken Jefferson. Your opponent in the May runoff, Mike Williams, came in second in the first election. He is outgoing Sheriff John Rutherford's hand-picked successor. That's who Sheriff Rutherford will be backing. It's a safe bet that Lenny Curry will be messaging in lockstep with Mike Williams when it comes to how to deal with violent crime.
Sure.
How is your approach different from Mike Williams?
Well, I don't intend to be lockstep with anyone because I will be a solely independent elected official. Responsible for fighting crime and being the chief law enforcement officer here in Jacksonville. I do look forward to working with the mayor, whoever the mayor is, hand in hand once the mayor is elected. But I don't think it is prudent for me to walk lockstep with anyone. Everyone has their own race to run. Everyone has their own issues. Everyone has their own platform, I would hope. And we stand on that and we present it to the people. We share our vision, and the people make the decision. And once the decision is made, it's prudent for a triangle effect to go into play. The sheriff, the mayor, and the prosecutor must work hand in hand once they're in the seats, in the office, with the ultimate objective of having public safety as a priority so that mm-hmm. our citizens can be safe in this city.
And public safety and the city's pension situation have been a huge campaign issue as well. What to do about pension reform, a plan that went before the city council failed on a deadlocked 9-9 vote just the other day. What are your thoughts about the path forward for the pension liability that affects police and fire employees?
Great question. And we've got to stop kicking the can down the road. We've been doing that for many, many, many years, and it appears that there's no end to it. You know, there was a bill that was proposed, and just on the face value and looking at it and listening from a distance, I thought it was a pretty decent bill, and I was shocked that they became deadlocked on the issue. I thought it was an opportunity to move forward for the best interests of everyone involved with this, particularly those that's going to be affected by the pension. I think that the city council and the mayor need to go ahead and resolve this. Of course, I guess it's easy for me to say from where I'm sitting that they need to go ahead and resolve it. But I think that's going to be the sounding voice of many here in our city, because it's been lingering far too long. They make a decision on it and move forward, because that's going to now give a breath of fresh air to all policemen and firemen that, okay, we've got a resolution, let's move forward. Now let's build up this morale in our city.
And we're speaking now with JSO Sheriff candidate Ken Jefferson on the show. Tomorrow we'll have the other candidate in the race, Mike Williams. What are your questions? Get on the line now. Let's go to your calls. 549-2937. Mark in Mandarin. Hi, Mark. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. My question is, with the increase in violent crime, what is the percentage of that drug-related? And then also, if the legalization of marijuana had passed, would those drug-related crimes drop, do you believe, as they have in Denver, Portland, and Washington, D.C.?
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for your call, Mark. The percentage of violent crime that's drug-related is about 40-50%. The drug trade actually drives violent crime. When you have drug dealers, drug users, people that are transporting drugs, people that are selling drugs, it all adds to the equation to increase violent crime here in our city. When we look at the other cities in the United States that has legalized marijuana, you know, there's pros and cons with that. There's not been a drastic increase in crime in those areas, in those cities, as a result of legalizing marijuana. And really, I think it's just a matter of time. You've got a few states that has it legalized now. I think it's just a matter of time before many states, if not all states, is going to have that as an issue to deal with. And you're going to see legalization in many other states. But my job as your sheriff is to make sure that law-abiding citizens are protected and those who would offend the law are arrested.
Bill in Orange Park, by the way, we're getting calls from outside Duval County at 549-2937. Bill in Orange Park. Go ahead, Bill.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, Mr. Jeffers.
Good morning. Good morning.
Mr. Jeffers, I think it was about 6 or 7 months ago, you were interviewed on First Coast Connect, and you made a statement about intervention in terms of youth, juveniles, in terms of juvenile crime, and I was really impressed with it. And I just want to bounce some things off you. There's a lot of cities, several cities that have developed programs where they incorporated police departments, state's attorneys, public defenders, and social service agencies. They went into communities and they actually talked to gangs and they talked to communities about the issues that communities are involved in, aside from the drug issue. And they did things like support for kids in those communities, support for parents in those communities where it was needed. But the end result was the fact that the gang issue decreased. And gangs actually, and I know for a fact in Boston, gang activity decreased. And gang members actually became partners in a lot of cases with police departments. So the rationale here is that you bring people in from agencies that generally don't really have an understanding of the urban environment, and you let them get a better understanding of it. And it seems to be a process that's working very well. And would that be something that you might entertain here in Jacksonville? And I take my answer up here. Thank you.
Thank you for that question, and you're paying close attention. You're absolutely right. About 7 months ago, I published a plan and put it on my website and pledged to decrease violent crime in our city by 25% my first year in office, which will address drug activity, gang activity, and overall violent crime. And in that plan, it does mention intervention. We've got to have something for our young people to do, but we've got to get them in their most impressionable stages of life between the ages of 9 and 12, when they're looking for a role model, when they're wondering what they want to be. How do I know that? Because I was that 11-year-old looking and wondering what I wanted to be when my life was totally changed by a person who later became my mentor, who was known as Officer Friendly. And he told us the role, spoke to us about the role of the police officer, not the enforcement role, because I understood that, but how a police officer can be a role model, how he can be a defender of those who can't fend for themselves, and how when he's on duty, children are at ease being outside and playing, and seniors feel good about their community because they know that Officer Friendly is there to protect them. So yes, I do have in my plan a mentorship program which involves intervention, but here's how we're going to do it. I, as your sheriff, I'm going to mentor an at-risk youth between the ages of 9 and 12, 1 hour a month, every month for my entire time in office. But not only am I going to do it, I'm going to have my senior staff on down to mentor a youth 1 hour a month, every month for my entire time in the office. Then I'm going to offer that same opportunity to 1,600 officers. I can't make them do it, but I can offer them to do it on a voluntary basis. And if I get buy-in from 50% of those officers, that's 800 children's lives who's going to be positively affected in a positive way so that we can create and mold and shape productive citizens. If we're proactive in this, we won't have to be reactive like we're being now. So yes, that's a part of my plan. I've done it before. I know how it works, and I can do it again.
549-2937. Lots of calls for Sheriff Candidate Ken Jefferson. We'll go to your emails, tweets, and Facebook comments in just a moment. AJ is in Bay Meadows. Hi, AJ. What are your thoughts?
Hey, good morning, Ken. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to know how is Ken Jefferson, if he becomes sheriff, how he's going to work with the community nonprofit organizations to help bridge the gap between police and community. It's a lot of mistrust, as we know. So just want to know how he's going to bridge that gap.
Thank you for that question, AJ. It's a great question. I want to reintroduce the police department back to the community. What I'm finding out from my walks and talks in various communities all over the city is that they basically see drive-by cops. There's no interaction.
What about, you know, when Sheriff Rutherford was on this program multiple times, he would say, we are in the community. We are doing community policing. We have these Shadco community groups. What about
that? Sure. Well, I listen to the citizens more so. I can easily say what I'm doing, but I listen to the citizens more so, and that's what they're telling me. They see drive-by cops. The only time a majority of them see the police is when it's time for enforcement. And that's not what we should be about. It should be a partnership because we can do better together. And what I intend to do is to not sit behind the desk. I cannot govern a sheriff's office from behind a desk. A politician will sit behind a desk and send surrogates out. But a sheriff will get from behind the desk and go and see about the people that he serves. Because at the end of the day, we're accountable to you, the taxpayers. So I intend to lead from the front. And it's all about leadership. I intend to be out in the community listening. And when I do my community walks, which I intend to continue to do, I don't need the press. I don't need the fanfare or the glitter. I don't even need a big entourage. I just need a few officers that's responsible for the area that I'm walking in so that I can introduce those officers to the community so they get a chance to know by name the persons that's responsible for their area. They can exchange numbers, and if there's an issue or concern, they can call that officer direct. Well, let's do some real community-oriented policing, but we have to lead from the front.
John on the south side. Hi, John. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call. And Mr. Jefferson, it's good to speak with you again. Last time I spoke with you was when you were running 4 years ago. And at that time, I extended an invitation just to kayak on Hogan's Creek. But what my question and concern is going forward, you know, right now we're into this celebration or this year celebration, you know, of our St. John's River. And my question has to do with how would you engage the community, you know, in the various, you know, tributaries and creek. I mean, we are a river city, and, you know, JSO does have a marine unit. And right now, my concern would be, you know, just engaging, you know, the community in all these outlying areas, and you know, what would be your approach, you know, to get, you know, people out, you know, to, you know, utilize the river, and what could be a positive, beneficial, you know, just wholesome experience, which ultimately could, you know, reduce crime and bring a sense of community to some of these neglected areas.
Thank you for your call, John. And I do remember you from 4 years ago, almost 5 years ago, and you did invite me to go out on the river in the kayak. Never had the opportunity to do it, but I still look forward to doing it someday. As your sheriff, my primary objective is to reduce and prevent crime in our city. And I think all of the assets that we have, I can partner with the parks, the tributaries, all the areas that we have, the beauty that our city offers. I think by working with someone like you, I would look forward to trying to develop ways that we can get people out more often to enjoy the beauty of our city, to enjoy all of its natural resources that we have. I mean, Jacksonville is a beautiful city. I was born and raised here. I've raised all of my children here, all five of my children here. And it's a place where I call home. I've called home for 57 years, and I don't intend to go anywhere. But I look forward to sitting down with people like yourself so that we can come up with new ideas and new ways to fight crime, number one, but partnering at the same time.
Johnny is in Washington Heights. Hi, Johnny. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa, how you doing? Long time no here.
Yeah.
My question for the candidate is, we know one of the, studies have shown one of the key causes of violent crime is poverty. How does he plan on attacking this violent crime without talking about the poverty?
Thank you, Johnny. And you're calling from a place where I grew up. I understand poverty. I understand being on welfare. I understand the plight of trying to rise from those type of situations. And you're absolutely right. Statistics have shown that poverty is a contributing factor to crime. But what we have to do is understand that the most power that a police officer has is not the gun, it's not the badge, it's not the arrest authority, it's discretion. And, you know, when you come across a situation, a nonviolent misdemeanor type situation, an officer's discretion can be easily used. Giving, you know, officers don't have the time all the time to assess a person's socioeconomical status. So he's not going to stand there if a person has committed a crime and say, okay, you're stricken by poverty. I'm going to give you a break this time. Persons that's living in poverty, they're just a little unfortunate than others, but they still have to abide by the law. They still should abide by the law, and an officer still has an obligation. So I wish I had the answer to that question to prevent poverty and prevent persons from being tempted to go and take some food because they're hungry or they have a family that's hungry, take it without paying for it or whatever. You know, you just look at the circumstances, you look at the person, then the officer has to make a decision.
And Daryl's in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Melissa. I seem to recall the Sheriff's Department supporting red light cameras and a private company executing the ticket for that. Seems to me the biggest problem in the Justice Department is transparency. Would you support, and Melissa, I hope you'll ask this to the other candidate, body cameras on all officers? I think the truth and sunshine will set us free.
Yeah, let's talk about body cameras and red light cameras. And yes, I will ask Mike Williams about that tomorrow. Ken Jefferson.
Thank you, Daryl. I was waiting on the body camera question. Thank you for segueing.
Sometimes our callers come up with the questions we don't always have time to get in. So, yeah.
Right. My position on body cameras is that I'm not opposed to body cameras. I think it's going to eventually be the wave of the future for law enforcement agencies. There are some cities that have body cameras right now. But my position is I would want to assess it a little bit further. I understand, you know, the outrage and the cry of the public right now. Body cameras, body cameras, body cameras. But let's look at every aspect of it first. Let's look at the legal aspect of it first. Let's look at the privacy issues of it first. Let's look at what would be available under public records. Let's look at what type of angle these cameras are going to provide. Let's look at when it should be turned on, when it shouldn't be. You know, there are things that I want to evaluate before I make a final decision to say yes. We need the body cameras because body cameras may not be the cure-all for our ills right now. But I think a prudent leader should just weigh it out, look at all situations before a decision is made. And that's what I intend to do. As far as red light cameras are concerned, what it does, it gives officers the opportunity to work high-frequency crash areas where crashes are regularly happening. Intersections are monitored, statistics are kept, and they have an opportunity to physically be there outside of where the red light cameras are. I know it was a private company. I know it was a deal that was made between the sheriff's office and that particular company, and I know it brings in a lot of revenue because people run red lights on a regular basis, and sometimes it causes crashes. If there was a contract for renewal, and I'll have to check to see if there is, but if there was a contract for renewal, I would definitely have to reassess whether or not they're being as effective as they should be, or it's just a waste of our time.
Lots of comments on our Facebook page for Sheriff Candidate Ken Jefferson. Here's one from Ann Duggar, who heads up the local Justice Coalition. Last year, there were 121 homicides in Jacksonville. What is your plan for JSO first responders to deal with the innocent victims at a crime scene?
Thank you for that question, Ms. Duggar. And there was 121 homicides in our city. But what we have to realize and what we sometimes forget is for every crime, there's a victim. And there's a person out there, a family out there that's being affected by this violent crime. The police does a good job of responding to the scene, investigating the incident, eventually sometimes or most times making the arrest, and it goes through prosecution things. But that victim is still there. That victim is one that's left alone who doesn't have as many rights as the person charged with it. I intend to intensify the victim's advocacy program that's already within the sheriff's office to make them more responsible for responding to crime scenes, for being there for families, for working with organizations such as the Justice Coalition, who does an outstanding job of advocating for innocent victims of violent crime.
Here's a question from Matt on our Facebook page. How do you feel about citizen oversight of the police? That's been a contentious issue for years, whether to have a citizen review board and so forth.
Citizens review boards have proven in other places in the United States not to be as effective as they thought it would be. I'm in favor of embodying a citizens' advisory council for the sake of advising the sheriff's office and the sheriff as to how we can better serve the community. Thoughts, ideas, creative thinking that we can do, or and then it also provides extra ears to the ground to help us know what's going on in various communities all over the city. This would be a combination of persons from all over Duval County, all 800 square miles. You know, a sheriff's office or a police department should reflect the community that it serves. This advisory council will reflect the community that we serve, and everybody will have a voice at the table.
Your opponent, Mike Williams, says he believes police shooting boards should be reopened to the public to restore public trust. He's also said he's also telling the voters, I'm a better choice because of my years of top administrative experience. And we will speak with him tomorrow. So sure. In closing, why are you a better choice in May to be the sheriff of Duval County over your opponent?
I'm a better choice because I'm connected to the community. My background, my experience speaks for itself. I've served in numerous leadership capacities within the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. In every place that I've had the honor of serving within the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, I've raised a level of performance. I was the federal program manager of the drug education for youth. That program under my leadership, it had about $1 million budget that we were responsible for to manage and to maintain that program. That became a national model under my leadership. That shows leadership. That shows management skills and experience. You know, when I was the public information officer, I was named as the spokesman of the year for two consecutive years. You have to have a working knowledge of the entire department to be a spokesman for a department. Everywhere that I've served, I've had the opportunity to increase and improve performances. Lastly, I'm the only candidate out of originally seven and only candidate now that has a written plan to reduce violent crime, drug activity, and gang activity. It's not a plan unless it's written. We can sit here all day and say, this needs to be done, that needs to be done. Well, how do you intend to do it? Well, my plan, which is on my website, www.ken4sheriff.com, it breaks it down as to how I intend to do it, which makes me well-qualified, well-prepared, and ready to serve as your next sheriff.
Ken Jefferson, thanks for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Later, two jazz greats join us with a preview of their big concert this week at UNF. But up next, a big new announcement for our First Coast Connect Book Club. We've got a big new partner, the library, and we'll tell you about it next.
Every day on Morning Edition, it's the news you can't do without.
This morning, we've been looking at what's happening.
There's conservatism, libertarianism, environmentalism, religion.
We're not props. We're just everyday people.
The crowd, the joy, the sense of hope.
Historic.
Listen to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
The Dinosaur Train is rolling into Orange Park. Thrasher Horn Center and WJCT present Jim Henson's Dinosaur Train Live, Buddy's Big Adventure, on Tuesday, May 12 at 6 p.m. See the beloved stars of the hit PBS series come to life on stage in your hometown for the first time. Join Buddy, Tiny, King, Don, and their family and friends in this fun-filled, interactive musical trip back in time. Tickets are on sale now at 904-276-6815 or thcenter.org.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
The Florida legislature is in session, and Capitol Report is your nightly connection to what's happening in Tallahassee as lawmakers debate and decide issues that affect all Floridians, such as expanding health care and gambling, protecting the state's water resources, private versus public schools, and prison reform. Hear Capitol Report each weeknight during the legislative session on this Florida public radio station.
That's Tuesday through Friday nights at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
And welcome back. Well, some exciting news on the show right now. Our popular book club segment now has a fantastic new partner, the Jacksonville Public Library. Yes, in the coming months, look out for news about the First Coast Connect Book Club and our monthly selections at your library branch. And hopefully, when it's a really in-demand book, we can find a way for you to get your hands on it. Speaking of which, we have a new book to discuss today and some other news and notes. Our First Coast Connect Book Club blogger Stacy Goldring joins us now with more about this month's selection, Anthony Doerr's bestseller, All the Light We Cannot See. Good morning.
Good morning. So excited about the library. Really, really psyched about it.
It is so great to know that the Jacksonville Public Library is putting its network in partnership with you, Stacy, as our incredible book club leader. Once a month, when people go to the library, they'll be able to see what book you're recommending that month. They'll have signage, probably extra copies
yes.
of the book that you've chosen, and more. This is a great partnership.
We are really looking forward to this. I just can't wait to get it started. But let's talk about All the Light.
All the Light We Cannot See from Anthony Doerr, which is a New York Times bestseller about a blind French girl and a German boy who are both trying to survive occupied France during World War II. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose this one?
This is what I call one of these it books. Very hot and I thought worthy of discussion for that reason. Melissa, I am a very picky reader. I'm a very selective facilitator because I don't want to waste people's time. So this book came at me with great force because there has been a lot of talk about it. It's a unique book. And I think what I want to do is give you my view from the other side of the table from a facilitator's point of view, which is a little bit unique. And I know Diane Rehm had a very interesting discussion on it last week. Mm-hmm. Here's what I have to say about this book. It's written very well. It's suspenseful. There are short chapters. You go back and forth in time. This author has an excellent way of creating suspense, not only using words, but using white space in order to give the reader pause, a chance to just kind of take in what just happened and shift gears, go back and forth in time. He also tried to use all the senses except sight because he felt in other things that he had written that he depended too much on the visual. So we have a lot of tactile, a lot of olfactory. It's a wonderful book in that way as well. The research on it, I have to be honest with you because I'm Jewish, it's really depressing.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to present a book like this and be neutral. But that's the job of a facilitator. So I found out some incredibly interesting things about our main character, Werner, who's obviously a fictional character. But I did some research because our character is involved with the Hitler Youth.
Yes. And he's sort of forced into the Hitler Youth, isn't he?
It's the lesser of two evils. It's either go work in the coal mines in Essen or take this opportunity because a talent was seen in him. He was very good with math and taking apart and putting things together again, radios. So he was selected to go to a Adolf Hitler school. And these schools were incredibly organized. They were incredibly well thought out. And I actually found online a 1938-1939 winter curriculum for the Jugendmädchen. And these were the girls in the Hitler Youth. Not only were boys recruited, but girls were too. We have two characters in this book, and one that isn't mentioned very often in the reviews is Uta, or Jutta, depending on how you want to pronounce J-U-T-T-A. This is his sister. She is her conscience. She is the I don't want to use the term lightly. She's the Jiminy Cricket on his shoulder for all the decisions she makes. He makes. She questions. And so it gives a counterbalance as we watch this boy fall into the slippery slope of the Hitler Youth. Mm-hmm. And she kind of, you know, she kind of calls him on it.
And so this is, as you said, this is one of those IT books that people can't get their hands on it. If they want to go to the library, it's probably checked out.
Yeah, you're like 254 on the list if you were to sign up this morning. It was crazy to get a hold of, very difficult. But we do have some bookstores in town that are willing. If you mention that you're part of the book group, they will give you a discount. I know the Book Nook and Chamblin's are participating. And so that's very nice. And it is in hardcover right now. I prefer soft cover so I can shove it in my purse. But right now it's strictly available in hardcover. So it's a big book. It's over 500 pages.
Yeah. So if you're just tuning in, our First Coast Connect Book Club and our own book club leader, Stacey Goldring, have partnered with the Jacksonville Public Library. Our monthly selections now will be promoted throughout the library system in Duval County. And as Stacey said, Chamblin's and the Book Nook will offer discounts on our book of the month. This month, it's the New York Times bestseller Anthony Doerr's All the Light We Cannot See. And as we continue to talk books, it's interesting because all throughout history, books have been banned. For one reason or another. You, Stacey Goldring, are actually part of an interesting initiative right now called BAND.
That's right.
Tell us about it.
Well, BAND is a program that will be, we're going to kick it off at One Spark, so we need volunteers. If anyone, any book club people, any book lovers would like to help volunteer, all you have to do is go to bandjacks1@gmail.com. Let me know and we'll sign you up at One Spark. But what BAND will do is it is community conversations about censorship in America. And we will have a series of programs that will all lead up to BAND Book Week at the end of September. And we are going to have really cool panels and discussions with experts about censorship in America. And I think it's really important right now. We just found out what's happened in Indiana. And of course, the Charlie Hebdo. There's a lot of issues about when does my freedom of expression trump your freedom to not like something or to be offended? And when does your right to be offended, you know, rub me the wrong way? So this is very tricky. So we're going to have these community conversations. Do you remember Fred Friendly seminars?
Sure.
Okay, I love those. So that's the kind of thing we're going to do. We're going to have, the venues are fabulous. We're going to be at the Comer. We're going to be at the Stetson Kennedy Landmark. We're going to be at the universities. We'll be at the colleges. We'll be in the schools, museums. We're going to be everywhere. And we are going to talk about these important issues because it's better to talk about our differences and kind of find that Venn diagram thingy of where we have common ground. Because if I want to look at art that I think is beautiful and you think is gross and offensive, well, let's find out why and come to some common ground. We can't hide from each other. So BAND will offer a wonderful venue to come together and talk about those very uncomfortable issues and try to find where we can move forward together. We're so cloistered. We're so we're all in our own tribal camps right now. We got to come out of that.
Absolutely. And it's so interesting that you're doing this initiative BAND because the book you've selected for next month, Dreaming in Cuban, mm-hmm. has been banned.
Of course, in Arizona.
Why is it banned?
Well, I don't want to read you the quote that the teacher said because it gives a bad name to teachers. But it's there's sex in the book.
So has it been banned in public schools? Is that what?
Yeah.
In Arizona.
Yeah, in a public school in Arizona. They yanked it off the shelves. Let me tell you about this book. Okay. We Americans soon will be able to get to hop on a plane and go to Cuba.
Right. Nonstop flight.
Havana. We're coming. So I thought, what a great book. We'll start with Dreaming in Cuban so we can literally go there first and feel for the island. Well, this island is wonderful. This book shows you the interesting cultures of Cuba, the conflicts of the exiles, those who stayed, those who left, those who want to have relations with Cuba, those who don't, those who love Fidel, those who are interested in Santeria. So many interesting things that I had no idea about. So I am so much smarter. I probably look taller to you right now because I have read this book, and I feel so bad for those students in Arizona who will have had their freedom of choice yanked from them because someone thought that something was inoffensive. This book was a national award finalist, National Book Award finalist. Okay, we don't really care much about awards, but that does have a little bit of street cred. And this book is an excellent entree to what in literature is called magical realism. And it talks about the politics, the geography, and the personal about three main characters, Celia, Lourdes, and Pilar. But there are a range of characters around these, living and kind of a little bit dead. But with magical realism, you're not quite sure if you're talking to a ghost, if you're having a dream, if you're imagining it, if maybe you sniffed some herbs you shouldn't have, whatever. This is a fabulous entree into Cuba. And it's so important that we approach this next step that we have with relations with Cuba with a little bit of knowledge. And sometimes fiction is a great way to gain knowledge about the real world.
Well, it's so exciting to always be promoting books and reading on this program with our own book club blogger, Stacy Goldring. The First Coast Connect Book Club is now in partnership with the Jacksonville Public Library. So when you go to the library, look for our logo and signage and Stacy's pick of the month. And they'll try to have extra copies for the books she picks. This month, it's Anthony Doerr's All the Light We Cannot See.
Mm-hmm. And then next month, we'll be reviewing Dreaming in Cuban by Christina Garcia. Go ahead and email your questions and comments about the book, and we'll talk about that on air.
Always great to see you.
Same, same.
See you soon. And we're back in a moment with the music of UNF's Great American Jazz Series. Stick around for that.
Looking for fresh music? Join us weeknights at 7 for After Hours. You'll hear everything from jazz to electronica, only on 89.9 FM After Hours.
Congratulations to writer James English, winner of the first quarter of The Square. Now it's your chance to show off your art, whether it's music, visual art, sculpture, poetry, and more. Go to wjct.org/The Square, check out the amazing local talent, and submit your work now.
When a mama and daddy moved into the house across the street.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet...
And who doesn't?
We're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, this Thursday night, UNF's 27th annual Great American Jazz Series presents Terrell Stafford and Dick Oates, a tribute to Nat and Cannonball Adderley. Acclaimed trumpet player Terrell Stafford, acclaimed saxophonist Dick Oates will be performing on stage. Here's a little preview of what you'll get to hear. This is Bohemia After Dark. Terrell Stafford, Dick Oates, both in studio now with a preview of Thursday night's show. Good morning, guys. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa.
So tell us a little bit about the show.
Well, we're going to be doing some music that was arranged for us by a great arranger, Mike LeBenny. And it is going to be a tribute to two of our favorite musicians, Nat and Cannonball Adderley.
Yeah, tell us about Nat and Cannonball Adderley, Dick Oates.
Wow. Well, Cannonball's been one of my favorites since I can remember playing the alto saxophone. And since he's from Florida, and he was such an amazing force in playing the alto saxophone, the music is going to be forever present in alto saxophone players everywhere in their lives. And so it's just such a tribute for us to be able to get this opportunity to play with these great arrangements and fantastic compositions of Nat and Cannonball.
Now, have you two performed together before?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Several times.
So you've got a nice rapport on stage?
We do. We perform every Monday night in the Village Vanguard.
Oh, very nice.
Jazz Orchestra.
Okay, old friends.
Old friends.
Old
friends. Old friends.
So, but this will be new for a Jacksonville audience. This will be a real treat for jazz fans and any music fan, it sounds like.
Yeah, I would think so, because it's what Cannonball and Nat contributed to the jazz scene is it's going to be forever, and it's an amazing opportunity for us to be able to share this with the University of Northern Florida, you know.
Now, great. Terrell Stafford, let's talk about the trumpet for a minute. You're an acclaimed trumpet player. Why did you pick the trumpet?
Because I've always loved the sound of the trumpet from the very beginning, and Nat Adderley was one of the first musicians that I ever transcribed on the trumpet, and I just always loved the sound. He played cornet, but I still love the sound that he got. And, you know, it's always been fascinating how you can get all these notes out of three valves. That's what attracted me when I was younger. It's like, wow, how can they do that with just three valves?
And Dick Oates, the sax is a very different instrument. Why did you choose it?
My father played saxophone. That's one. And then I heard Johnny Hodges, and that was it for me.
And that was it. That was
that
all
was it. That's what I want to do, yeah.
How do you blend your two instruments, your sounds, together on stage? What's that process like?
I think, you know, we're both very sensitive when it comes to, you know, we played a lot of music, a lot of similar types of music, and we came up in a similar kind of a background of appreciation of what we play and who we like to sound like when we were younger.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've always been a huge fan, even from my younger days, going to hear Dick Oates at the Village Vanguard, so from my perspective, I just fit into his sound, and I know it'll be okay.
Very nice. Well, it's a little colder up there right now than down here, so are you enjoying your time in Florida so far?
Oh, yeah. I just want to come down here and live.
Hey, come on down. We have a lot of New Yorkers that have transplanted down here.
Yeah,
and not all in South Florida.
That's true.
Let's talk for a minute, too, about UNF's Great American Jazz Series. You guys are the latest in a long line of incredible world-class musicians they've brought in. For people that have never been to one of these concerts and aren't even familiar with the genre, what would you say to those folks out there who are just now hearing about this?
Well, the university has an incredible big band, so that's, you know, first and foremost, and the students are fantastic. So just let alone what we do or what the series has done, just to come out and support all the great work they do. But, you know, jazz is such a treasure here in America, and to keep it alive, we need to come out and support these artists as much as possible so that they can continue this series.
Would you agree, Dick Oates?
I concur.
All right. Well, we're going to close with a little more jazz. It's a preview of Thursday night's UNF's 27th Annual Great American Jazz Series, presenting Terrell Stafford and Dick Oates in a tribute to Nat and Cannonball Adderley. This is Thursday night, 7:30 p.m. at UNF's Robinson Theater. Gentlemen, a pleasure, and thanks so much for getting up early with us and giving us this preview. Have a great show.
Thanks, Melissa.
We'll close with a little more Bohemia After Dark on the program. I'm Melissa Ross, and thanks for tuning in. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow with Jack Sheriff candidate Mike Williams. Have a great day. Enjoy the music. We'll be right back.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.